Creativity, I think, comes into the process initially when you need to get people to think beyond their standard timeframes. I am what I would call a realistic optimist. And this means that there's no point removing yourself from trying to be part of the solution. And equally, there's no point assuming that somebody else is going to solve it all. You need to step up and participate and actually try and be a part of the solution. One of the things I work with clients on is, how do you find the right questions to ask? So rather than just being neck deep in AI, take a step back out and say, what are the right questions we should be asking about this technology?
Hello and welcome to the Common Creative Podcast. My name is Chris Meredith.
And I'm Paul Fairweather. And Chris and I are on a mission to lift the lid on creativity in life and business through the lens of ideas, stories, and visual cognition.
And this week's guest is Roger Dennis. He advises top-tier companies on the future. He says he describes himself as an expert in foresight, but he's not a futurist. And interestingly, he trained in psychology and zoology. And so he uses all of those tools and techniques to help big business plan for what might be in the future.
Chris, I think this is probably one of the most quietly spoken yet provocative guests we've ever had. His thinking on timescales, it really was mind-stretching, I suppose, or hopefully time-stretching as well. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation, and as always, we could have talked on for hours and hours. There's so much more I wanted to learn from Roger.
Folks, so that people listen right through this one, we need more philosophers, less programmers. That's from a foresight expert. He talked about the power of storytelling so that people really understand and take action on what might be in the future. And then he finished with this point about heirlooms. Listen on to hear why heirlooms matter.
And we're not talking about the tomato heirlooms either. So heirloom tomatoes. Let's get him in.
Roger Dennis, a huge welcome to the show. Great to have you on The Common Creative.
Great to be here. Thank you. Welcome, Roger.
Roger, I wondered for our listeners if you could tell us a bit about what you do. It's tempting to call you a futurist, somebody who's seen to the future, tell us what life's going to be like in the future. But I know that's not how you describe yourself. But you are, your business is concerned with what's going to happen. Tell us more. What do you do? And how did you get to be where you are now?
Wow, there's a two-pronged question there. But I'll start with the first bit, which is what I do is I help leadership teams, typically chief execs and boards, understand where the world is going beyond normal strategic planning timeframes, and then start to say, if the world is changing in that way, what does that mean for the business we're in? And then most importantly, what are the right strategic questions we should be asking? So typically, innovation and strategy usually happens so at the very bottom end of that cascade of questions. And then people get caught by surprise. You know, we didn't expect that. We didn't see that coming. And a lot of the work that I do is trying to get ahead of the surprise to mitigate risk or realize opportunity.
What led you to this field? It's fascinating. But there aren't many people at lead school going, I'm going to be a person specializing in foresight.
Yes, that is a very good point. And it's a typical sort of wiggly career path. And at university, I did one degree in psychology, the other degree in zoology. So it's very useful if you need to psychoanalyze your goldfish, understand why it's feeling a bit anxious from going around in circles. After that, I did a whole range of things. I did freelance broadcasting in Hong Kong. I had a range of different careers, but ended up in technology for a while, worked in London for a long time, but got very frustrated at conversations with leadership teams at the time where you would talk to them about something where you could clearly see that their world was going to change, but effectively the response was something similar to, did you watch the football last night? Is it going to rain tomorrow? Because they just couldn't get their head out of the paradigm they were stuck in. And so just moving up the chain into strategy and then into foresight to help open up some of those conversations to think about what could be possible and what you should think about in order to prepare for an uncertain future.
So, Roger, why are we human beings so short-sighted? Why don't we want to embrace things that might be? I'm very aware that people kind of, if it's not warmer in my backyard, if there isn't flooding in my backyard, that's a good evidence for there's no climate change, for example. Why are we like that? Why are we so myopic?
We're not very well equipped to think long term because evolution has really set us up to focus on the here and now. And if you look at ways of communicating that resonate long-term thinking, what you find is that producing interesting documents, even colorful documents with mind charts, for example, on A4 bits of paper, doesn't get you anywhere close to helping people go past standard thinking. And so what I've learned working in this field for over two decades now is that you really need to create methods of communication which resonate strongly.
You're talking to the right audience there, Roger.
Roger, as you know, this is the Two Common Creatives, and Chris are on this mission about unpacking creativity in life and business. And we're talking earlier about stories, ideas, and visual cognition. I'm really interested in, you know, you're sort of looking, I think you said about stories about the exponential future. So I suppose what I'm interested in is, like, we're preparing for a future that we can't see. And maybe this is a very big question, but where does creativity come into this? You know, do we have the options? Is it creativity in the preparation? Because, you know, we're on the train that's, you know, heading for the cliff. You know, we can't change the train. Or can we have a bigger impact? Where does creativity come in?
Creativity, I think, comes into the process initially when you need to get people to think beyond their standard timeframes. So, like I said, you can't do this by producing A4 documentation or even, gasp, A3 documentation.
PowerPoint? What about PowerPoint?
Oh, PowerPoint. That's a clear winner. And so, you know, I'll give you an example where I did a piece of work that goes back to 2007, 2009, where my team worked with a healthcare organization. And the brief from the chief executive was they can see the cracks appearing in healthcare in the future, but they just can't understand how they could bring 18,000 people on that journey to change the way they work. And so, to cut a very long story short, what we did is we took over a 10,000 square foot warehouse. We converted it to the cross between an interactive museum, a corporate roadshow, and a vision document brought to life. We used theatre set designers, carpenters, electricians, painters, videographers, etc. We built a series of exhibits, and people went through this in groups of 10, and we brought to life the story of healthcare, how it was, how it could be now, and how it should be in the future. And what we found is that by doing it in this way, people suddenly understood how things needed to change, what their part was they could play, and what a different future actually looked like. It was one of the foundations for a globally renowned transformation program that wildly exceeded our expectations. And there's absolutely no way we could have got to that point by doing an A4 document.
Paul and I are both passionate storytellers, and you're definitely preaching to the converted in this idea that people connect through stories. And yes, it's great to hear somebody else having a bit of a go at PowerPoint and A4 documents and so on and so on. Have you any tips on what makes a powerful story? You talked about that structure, past, now, future. I'm guessing that's one of the components. How do you bring stories to life so people get engaged, people get on board with new ideas?
So one of the books I frequently reference people to look at is Made to Stick by Dan and Chip Heath. So one of them is a Stanford professor, and they have analyzed how it is that things like urban legends can successfully pass from person to person like an idea virus, with little bits and pieces changing along the way, but the essence of the story remains the same. And so if you look at the process they outline in that book, and there are others as well, but if you're starting, Made to Stick would be a great entry point. Then if you look at that process, the idea behind it is to create a narrative that resonates so strongly that people can pass it along to other people who can then pass it along again. So with that health example I just talked about, what we did was we used some of that style of storytelling to create a social movement where people would invite other people to come along, and there was no directive top-down invitation, but it was the social movement that spread by creating a great narrative.
So you're suggesting that you kind of want to form a community around an idea. So you don't think of it, I'm not telling a story, I'm building a band, you know, a tribe. I'm creating something I want people to get on board with. Would that be fair? I'm thinking this leads into the whole idea of politics and campaigns and so on.
Absolutely. Another example would be a piece of work I've just done for an organization where they were interested in 50-year investment timeframes. And they had a very diverse set of stakeholders in the community. They manage, you know, a couple of $1 billion of investments. And what we ended up doing is one part of it is creating a 3D printed representation of some of the key aspects of that 50-year strategy. And when you look at this printed artifact and you hand it on to someone and you tell them what it's about, you see their eyes light up. And then they're equipped to tell that story to the next person because the artifact creates that resonance. It's different, it's interesting, it has so many different strands through it that it starts the conversation. If you can't start conversations, you're dead in the water.
Roger, I just wanted to sort of go back literally to this thing about the story. And I use a framework which is about past, present, and possibility as well. I'm interested in your take about, you know, we can't look at, you know, what's happened before to know where we're going to go because it's going to be new and different. What do we learn from the past? Is it the fact that it was different and so therefore it's going to be different again? Or what lessons can we take from looking at the past and comparing it to where we are now?
So I'll give you two examples. That's a great question. First would be humanity is incredibly resilient. So if you look at the horrific bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, then those cities have not quite bounced back, but decades later, they are still functioning cities in the face of, you know, horrific wartime atrocities. The other example would be people at the moment are using the term polycrisis, and polycrisis is like compounding crises, interacting with another crisis to create a sort of metastasizing series of uncertainty and volatility and complex events. Now, if you look back through recent human history, in the late 60s, arguably was a genuine polycrisis. You had war in the Middle East, you had space race tensions, you had the launch of the Boeing 747, you had Intel, you had millions rioting on the streets of Paris, you had Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy assassinated. It was just been on and on and on. What's interesting is if you look at commentary from that time, people reflect that it felt like the world was imploding, yet here we are. Now, I would say the key difference between that time and where we are now is that the base environment that civilization relies on is degrading to the point where it's going to have fundamental implications for intergenerational outcomes. And as you pointed out earlier, Chris, humans are not very good at looking past generations.
Roger, let me pick you up. There's some long words there, fundamental implications for I guess what I want you to kind of make clear, are you worried about the future?
I am what I would call a realistic optimist. And this means that there's no point removing yourself from trying to be part of the solution. And equally, there's no point assuming that somebody else is going to solve it all. You need to step up and participate and actually try and be a part of the solution. So while I am worried about some parts of the future, there is no point just sitting back with a, you know, Pollyanna sort of view with a couple of beers and thinking, well, either it's no use or someone else can take care of it. You've got to step up.
Yeah. And it's interesting, I have actually personally heard some Australian politicians taking that view. There's no point. We needn't bother because there's nothing we can do, which is outrageous, I think. But it's interesting, there are people out there. That leads me to a burning question. I'm dying to get your view on, as you know, we've been recording a number of
podcast episodes about artificial intelligence, and it polarizes people. This new, I was going to call it a toy, I think that's probably the wrong way of talking about it, this new technology, which both offers extraordinary opportunities and potentially extraordinary danger. Now, I know you're not in the business of forecasting, it's more about how do you plan for things, but I'd love to hear your opinions about how artificial intelligence either might be harnessed or how we might plan for this uncertain future that it seems to bring.
So I'll provide an answer and couch it in what I think is required now. And what I think is required now is less programmers and more philosophers. I don't think we need more people rushing headlong into developing new and incredible software tools. I think we need more people stepping back and looking at the implications of these new tools. So with every technology, there is risk and opportunity. The key fundamental difference, I think, at the moment with AI is that there is the potential for an acceleration of machines that create better machines without human interaction. And that is quite different to previous industrial-type revolutions where they required people in the mix to use those machines to go faster. So that's the key. The other thing I would say at the moment is that I have a couple of colleagues who are deep subject matter experts in this space. So one of them 2 weeks ago commented to me that they're having trouble keeping up with developments in AI. And my response is, if they're having trouble keeping up, then no one is keeping up.
Yeah.
And this is heading into very uncertain territory from a humanity point of view.
But it's fascinating what you said, that one of the ways we can step up is that we need more philosophers, less programmers. And that really struck home for me because, you know, if you look at our educational system, you know, all the kids are being encouraged to learn more about programming and the technology side of it. I haven't heard anyone banging the drum for philosophy, because philosophy is something we did in the olden days. It was an academic kind of esoteric thing. No one gives a stuff about that stuff, really, do they? And you're saying, no, that's vital. Tell me more. How do we get more philosophers?
That is a great question. And one of the things I work with clients on is, how do you find the right questions to ask? So rather than just being neck deep in AI, take a step back out and say, what are the right questions we should be asking about this technology?
Ooh.
I find it fascinating. So, gosh, for the last 10 or so years, I have been just against this idea that in order for your children to prosper in the world, you should emphasize that they should become programmers. And my response was, actually, by the time those children enter the workforce, programming a computer will be like training a dog. And that's exactly where we're going to. And so people have this idea that because they've got well-paid jobs and they're making a good living out of the profession, that if their children simply follow that career path, then actually they will have the same career progression, same status and same income. But actually, if you think about the trajectory of where software is going, I would argue that the umbrella aim is to get software to the point where it's intelligent enough and seemingly smart enough to be able to do a bunch of tasks without needing human coders.
So obviously where it's going, when you said before that no one can keep up with AI, it's probably the only person is keeping up with AI is AI itself, if you ask it the right question. But I just wanted to go back to like an earlier comment. I was struck when you were talking about the poly crisis. Before we go on, we had a guest recently who said, you know, she's always amused when people saying we're living in unprecedented times. But she said, tell me, when were you living in a precedented time? You know, when did you know what was going to happen? So I think it's really interesting because we do have this sort of fallback and just say we're not really good at looking at, you know, predicting the future or thinking about long time frames. But we have this thing of, yeah, we think, oh, well, you know, we never accept that it's precedented. You know, we always know it's unprecedented times. So anyway, that was just a comment. Ask a question.
So that's a really good observation. And if you look back to previous periods in history, you can see precedents for unprecedented advances. So the mid-1800s, late 1800s, you had things like the telegraph, electricity, all these things coming through, which created massive disruption. So if you think about the scale of disruption caused by the telegraph, the paradigm was changed so markedly at the time that there's a story about the guy who owned the Pony Express, which went from San Francisco across the states. And when the first telegraph was commercially unveiled, they could send messages across the nation in the blink of an eye. The story goes that the owner of the Pony Express challenged the telegraph to deliver a message faster than his ponies could. So you think about what's going on there, right? So someone gets a bit of paper, they write on it, they fold it in half, they stick it in a leather satchel on the back of a horse, they slap the horse's ass, go. By the time that process has happened, the message has already arrived. So you think about the degree of disruption with telegraph and electricity and the railroad. That's incredible. However, what we have now, which is quite different, as you point out, is AI, machines that create faster and better machines without humans in the loop, and environmental degradation, which seems to be accelerating. So those are two key differentiators between historical examples of unprecedented technology developments and today.
I saw a great etching this morning of an old technology that's no longer in use, and it was an etching of a military man, and it was the pigeon holder. the earlier version of the radio operator had a vest, and not only could he have one pigeon on his hip, he could have three on his chest.
See, technology advancements like that were unprecedented. The four pigeon holder.
Yeah, Roger, I was just going to say, the person that sprung to mind when you talked about not encouraging the kids at schools to be programmers, you know, that we need philosophers, it's Sir Ken Robinson. He's sort of no longer with us, unfortunately, but his point, his mission was about encouraging schools to teach creativity. I guess what I'm hearing from that is let's go beyond that. It's not just teach creativity, but teach thinking, teach philosophy, teach people how to step back and ask questions, I guess is what you're saying. And don't worry about programming. Don't worry about kind of technical stuff, because that's probably going to be out of date by the time you need to use it.
Absolutely. And what I find really fascinating when you step back at the high level and look at the advances in AI that have happened in the last 6 months. Prior to that, essentially, most predictions were focused on rules-driven jobs. So lawyers, accountancy, anything which was repetitive and relied on a set of rules, then software would outperform people on. However, if you look at what's happening with ChatGPT, where it can write poems, it can write love letters, you've got Midjourney, which can do stunning art. It turns out that by actually vacuuming up all creativity online, you enable those tools to be creative in themselves. So I find that astonishing. Mm-hmm. And the logic part will come later. So what happens when you have software which is supremely and unquestionably logical in its reasoning, plus creative, to the point where it can amalgamate all of humanity's creativity and combine the two?
I can feel a reality movie coming up.
A sci-fi horror movie. Roger, this talk of time frames just reminds me of a little video I saw last week called Time to Scale. If you've seen it on YouTube, we'll put a link in the show notes if you check it out and let us know. But it's these two guys went to Mojave Desert to map out time using lights, and they did the last million years, and then they did all of time over 6 kilometers, and the first one was over 1 kilometer. But the telling thing is, in the end, after they do the 6 kilometer, how he demonstrates the last million years, and just to give perspective on this time frame, and it's really looking back, but it, you know, it has that thing of, you know, like the next 100 years is nothing, you know, or 1,000 years is nothing in the time frame. But it's really worth having a look at. It's called Time to Scale. It's really sensational.
That reminds me, if you look back at human history, and you had say a 30-centimeter ruler that basically measured humanity's time on the planet, and you looked at mapping significant inventions on that ruler, sort of about the 15-centimeter mark, you might get fire, you know, 25 centimeters wheel, and then the last centimeter, you get flight, space, antibiotics, medicine, and just goes absolutely bonkers. And yeah, so this is where my comment around philosophy versus program is, because just the sheer volume of human invention in the last 150 years has been astonishing compared to the rest of history. Mm. And that sort of comes back to where we started this, which was, how do you tell a narrative that enables people to start thinking beyond the normal timeframes? Because as a species, we're not set up to comprehend the speed at which we are innovating at the moment.
Mm. So maybe we need to have philosophers looking at creativity as well, because maybe it's not to the AI that's doing the damage. There's a great story, and again, maybe an urban myth, but I have read it that it was true, about the college at Oxford that had to replace its oak roof. Which, you know, goes that they found a forest that had been planted 300 or 400 years earlier for the very purpose of replacing those roofs.
Yeah, so that I'd heard that story as well, and I spent quite a bit of time digging into it. And it is unfortunately an urban legend. However, when you dig a few layers deeper, it gets even more interesting. So what happened in, I'm not saying it's medieval England, but probably a period later than that, was that in order to produce enough good quality wood for the British Navy, the villagers would plant oak trees and tend them multiple generations, knowing that those trees would be used for a navy and to extend sort of the reach of the empire in a time frame that they would never see, which I found even more extraordinary than the university oak beam story.
Yeah. Actually, I had a friend, an old client, Chris Medland, and he bought a property down in northern New South Wales, and he planted about a couple of thousand joinery timber trees as a gift for his children, of his grandchildren, for that, and inspired a little project in me, which I discontinued, but I'm about to restart it. It's called Tree Two House, and it's a gift card with two seeds, and one seed is to build a tree house with, and the other tree is to build a tree house in. So it's a gift for your children's grandchildren on the basis of that story, and now this true story about the villagers making the timber boats.
I'm going to keep in mind that if back in the day when there was a system for planting oak trees that you would never see harvested, we don't seem to have anything like that today. I'm wondering what if it becomes an advert for either dictatorships or monarchy, because democratic politicians work on a 4 or 5 year time frame, whatever it might be. You need leaders who are working on a 200-year time frame to enable oak trees to be planted in that way. Is there something in that, or how? I guess the more serious question is, how do we set up frameworks that allow us to think beyond the next political cycle or beyond our own generation?
So I'll give you two examples. One is a very Californian Silicon Valley example, and I'm a member of the Long Now Foundation, and the Long Now Foundation really does exist to, I guess, increase an awareness of changes in the world beyond standard lifespans. So they're working on a project, I think it's the 10,000-year clock, on Jeff Bezos's ranch in the middle of somewhere. And the idea is a clock that lasts 10,000 years and it's precision engineered. And you can look it up online. It's a fascinating project. Another one would be the Timber Library in Oslo in Norway, which has only been developed in the last 3 or 4 years by this fascinating artist. She's Scottish. Her name has just temporarily escaped me, but I will send a link and you can put it in the show notes afterwards. And she is populating this library with books that can't be read until the library opens formally in 100 years' time, I think it is. And it's this idea that actually you think beyond your own lifespan, what would you leave the next generation? And this artist is really interesting because I think it's a contrast to the 10,000-year clock, which is sort of artistry versus techno-wizardry, how I'd roughly sum it up. Both are interesting examples of forcing long-term thinking, but very different approaches.
But it sounds as though you either need to be a billionaire or a bit of a weirdo then to think those thoughts.
I'm not a billionaire, so...
No, it's interesting. I mean, but from a family perspective, is it walnut? No, it's olive trees. You don't plant olive. It's one kind of you don't plant them for you. You don't plant for your children. You plant them for your grandchildren. So as a family member, you might do things that go down the generations. It's just strange to me that we need more than that to plan for all the deal issues that we're dealing with today. And somehow we've lost that ability to plan.
Yeah, and if we want to get really deep on this, then the current neoliberal economic theory on which capitalism has thrived so well since the end of World War II is really based on consume. Consume, mm-hmm. consume, consume. That's essentially what shopping malls are for, endless consumption. Yeah. But if you look at the other end of that spectrum, which is landfills, they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so I've started getting really interested in the last 10, 15 years in buying products which are quality, which are going to last a long time, and which actually create intergenerational outcomes. It's really challenging, though, in this environment. My family are always hassling me because before I buy anything, I will spend, a week reading reviews, checking longevity, reliability, because I don't want to be the person that buys something, takes it to get serviced, and they say it's cheaper to buy a new one.
Yeah.
That's the prevalent paradigm right now. Consume, consume, consume.
So there's an answer in philosophy, in our minds, which is let's get out of this paradigm with this way of thinking, which is when something stops working, I just buy another, or I buy things knowing that they're going to fail and buy another and get out of that. I personally identify that story. I've kind of get more and more pleasure from repurposing things or fixing things, whatever. It's fun, but it's interesting. You're saying that the answer's in people changing the way they view consumption, I suppose.
I think that's definitely part of the answer. And for organizations that can get their leadership teams above the here and now, that also becomes an opportunity. And so if you think about what makes an heirloom, then that changes the way you create products and you deliver services. What is it that's going to create intergenerational outcomes or is going to last more than 20 or 30 years? And that's challenging to that whole neoliberal economic theory because that sort of led to this rate of basically destruction of corporations where you lose knowledge around what creates value through generations. And if you look at corporate history, what you're seeing is the lifespan of a company getting shorter and shorter itself. Mm. And so the ability to think beyond intergenerational timeframes is really challenging when the timeframe of the structures that create stuff are also shrinking.
Roger, that is absolutely fantastic. And I think sadly our time is up, but I think that last point you make about how do we make heirlooms is a fantastic to end on, and also the sentiment around, you know, this whole thing that's driving us about consume, 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 which, you know, I'm working out how to stop doing. However, I'd like our listeners to consume, consume, consume this podcast because there's many great lessons in there to be learned. Well, hopefully they will have done that by the time they get to this part of the podcast.
Paul, perhaps you and I should talk about how we get our grandchildren to carry on the golden creative fire so that this itself becomes an heirloom.
But I do actually think, Roger, you raised a point there about, you know, like fixing things and making do. I think that is a topic, Chris, that we should pick up again.
Yeah.
Anyway, Roger, thank you so much for your time. It's been absolutely fantastic. We could go on for another hour and a half or longer, I'm sure.
And if you want to learn more about that, so I'm on LinkedIn. That's where all my posts typically end up. And if you want more mind-expanding content that gets you out of the day-to-day, then just look me up on LinkedIn. It's easy to find.
Fantastic. We'll put all the links in the show notes, Roger.
Thank you so much, Roger. And we look forward to getting you back on the show in a couple hundred years.
Thanks for your time. Good talking.
Chris, wow, that my mind stretching as I said.
Intergenerational outcomes. How can we do things that affect the generations? How do we plant oak trees for future generations? How do we do wonderful. Well, so grateful to Roger for joining us.
No, sensational. I think Chris, the tree is the walnut tree that you were thinking of, not the olive tree. It's the walnut tree. That
maybe it is.
Take forever. Yeah, look, absolutely fantastic. I'm going to re-listen to this and link follow Roger on LinkedIn to see some of his further provocations. So a great chat. All his notes and links will be in the show notes.
And as ever, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Please give us a comment. What do you think of this idea of heirlooms? What do you think about the idea of storytelling from helping people take action? Tell us what you think. We'd love it if you'd give us a rating. We hopefully have a 5-star rating, but please give us a rating so we know what you're enjoying and so on. And last and not least, tell your mates about the Common Creative Podcast. We want to spread the word about creativity, and it helps us, it helps our listeners if you're kind enough to do that.
Yeah, and tell your colleagues and bosses as well, not just your mates. They might learn something too. So please tune in next week for our next exciting episode of the Common Creative Podcast.
See you next week.